Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and that's our weekly Q&A with Layla. We're now in part two, and what's the next question, Layla, please?
This is from Michael. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Since any external substance or xenobiotic is considered as a stressor to the body in general, can one measure the degree of sensitivity or allergy degree to a food or to another substance that gets into the body by measuring the relative amount of cortisol and adrenaline in the saliva rather than detecting a change in arterial pulse?
Well,
did we just lose the audience?
So this is interesting. Let me explain what he's saying. He's saying that, you know, when the body is hit with whatever, whether it's a typical allergic reaction,
yeah.
Or it could be, you know, I put a little bisphenol A on your, you know, in your something that comes out of your canned soup.
Yes.
You know, because it was sitting in a can that has BPA liner.
Right, which most cans do.
Anything. Or if if you get a whiff of diesel exhaust from the bus that's pulling up in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the city buses are okay, but those buses that go to like New Jersey or
that's
you
true,
know,
they're not electric.
Or whatever. Right. You know. Mm-hmm. Anyway. So, this is a little bit like what chiropractors like to do and other types of health practitioners with kinesiology. They expose you to something and then they push down on your arm or they use some kind of reaction. They try to break your, if you make a ring with your forefinger and your thumb and they try to break it.
Huh.
They sort of see if your body is being stressed and they're paying lip service to this idea. It's an interesting idea. What he's referring to in terms of an allergic response is what's called the COCA pulse test, which is actually developed in the 60s and 70s by an allergist named COCA, who was not, he was an innovative allergist. And he said people may be manifesting allergic reaction in their nervous system. So you can actually check your pulse after you eat an incriminating food and see if your pulse goes up.
Yeah. It's important to get a baseline before you eat. Get a baseline.
Right.
Your pulse per minute, and then do it again shortly after.
Do you find that works?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
And back when I used to be a patient of Dr. Teach,
Dr. Teach is
innovative
allergist in New York, still practicing.
Said, you've got a wheat thing going on, you can't have, and lo and behold, when I would do the tests at home, pulse is fine, normal, and then I'll eat some bread, and then take my pulse and wow.
Okay, so that's one of the ways. But is there, now he talks about cortisol. Now cortisol is a relatively slow response.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Adrenaline is something that's a relatively rapid response.
Yeah.
So if I say, Layla, it's your mother calling.
Mm.
Check your adrenaline.
Oh yeah.
It's going to go up.
Check my adrenaline right now. Yes. My mother is 82.
Okay,
yes.
Right. It's like, call from your mother.
Yeah.
So relatively quickly you'll mount a response. Cortisol is something that is a slower response. They're both released by the adrenals, but adrenaline is, we all know in popular culture what adrenaline is. It makes your heart race and you feel excited and fight or flight, that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we could actually maybe hook somebody up to an experimental device that's like a continuous glucose monitor, that's a continuous
adrenaline monitor
and just sort of see blip, blip, blip. I mean, the other thing to do is, lie detector tests work along those lines.
That's true.
To measure changes in breathing or galvanic skin response, which is a little sweating on the surface of the skin.
Galvanic skin response.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's there are ways to determine if people are stressed when they're answering a question.
Yeah.
That doesn't work out that well because people sometimes stressed when they're telling the truth.
That's really something.
This is an interesting idea. I don't know if it's, and the other way that this is done is in some doctor's offices, they use these electrodiagnostic devices, which I kind of really don't believe in.
But,
different things. And then what they do is they measure physiologic response
in
a way that's similar maybe to a lie detector. But people hold a wand and there's something electrically transmitted.
Mm-hmm.
And when people are, I don't know quite how it works, but when people have a adverse response to a challenge and they usually put something under your tongue or I don't know what they do, you see the machine will read out that there's a reaction. So you're thinking along the right lines, but I mean, let's say something is really poisonous or toxic for you, but you don't have an initial response. You know, kind of gets in under your radar, and you know, you don't do well. So an example of which, let's say you have celiac disease.
Yes.
And if you have celiac disease, and I put like a communion wafer on your tongue, it's made of gluten, and you chew it up and swallow it, that may not cause an immediate reaction. That may cause a reaction in your gut that, you know, takes a while to develop.
And it may not trigger any adrenaline at all.
Right, right.
So,
yeah.
That's interesting.
You know, so there's so many ways in which people react. Food is information. Smell is information. I mean, the smell of lavender, you know, changes your brain waves. I mean, I guess another way to do this is maybe to put people into a PET scanner where they look at the regions of your brain and then
see what lights up.
And then put something in your mouth and see if your brain changes.
Yeah.
You know, that there's a pattern of some brain change in relation to it. I mean, I know that people might, their brain might light up when they put, you know, chocolate on their tongue or something like that. You know, in a good way.
In a good way, exactly, right. Exactly. Michael, what a thoughtful question. Wow.
Okay. So. Yeah, Michael, you know, when you invent the machine, I'll just take a 10% royalty on it.
There you go.
Okay. My advice is free for now. All right, so let's pause now because we're going to allow one of our sponsors to share an important message with you. Here goes. Please listen up.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. And we want to thank them because throughout the year, they've been there for us. And we hope that you're supporting them. And, you know, they wouldn't keep supporting us if they didn't feel it was worthwhile messaging to you, a very well-informed audience of consumers. So thanks to both you and our sponsors. Now back to our questions. What's next, Layla?
Okay, we've got an email from Bonnie. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. After checking into your bone health protocol and reading your newsletter article...
By the way, bone health protocol, it's on Full Script.
Yes.
Just drhoffmanstore.com, I think, is the place to go.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, or drhoffman.com and click on the store.
And click on the store, right.
Yeah, you could go there too. After checking into your bone health protocol, reading your newsletter article on Ostera, and Ostera is the hops-derived product. I recently suggested
it works
it to
in a way
friend.
That's similar to Prolia. It works on that similar pathway, the NF-kappa-B pathway that relates to inflammation that promotes bone loss.
Okay. Slows down that rapid turnover rate. Bonnie recently suggested it to a friend along with Osteothera plus Ipraflavone and the protocol of vitamin K2,
right.
MK7. We are both curious, Bonnie says, as to why Ostera has 500 micrograms of vitamin K1 instead of K2.
Right.
What does vitamin K1 have to do with bone health? Everything. It's part of the matrix.
So that's interesting, because really...
This is
informing me, because I'm well aware that vitamin K2 has potent bone-enhancing capabilities.
Yes.
We call it the crossing guard of calcium, where it tells calcium to stay away from the arteries and go more towards bone deposition.
But vitamin K1
also has some...
K1 has more to do with homeostasis in the body than anything else.
Okay.
And vitamin K1 we get primarily from dark green leafy vegetables. Mm-hmm. Vitamin K2, as found in MK7, we get from meat as well as from cheese.
Cheese and this weird-tasting thing called natto is
natto,
a great sort, which
exactly.
most Americans don't like.
Exactly.
It's a Japanese fermented soybean product.
Right, right. So have your miso soup, have a salad and a steak. You're getting the whole matrix of K.
And have some aged cheese.
have some aged cheese.
Which is maybe responsible for the Dutch paradox, or where they consume an enormous amount of aged cheese there. But their cardiovascular disease risk is not high, you know.
Yeah, it could be the vitamin K that they're getting, yeah. So Bonnie goes on to say, my friend is adding up all the vitamin K2 in her various supplements with the 200 micrograms in Osteothera and the 160 in the protocol. She's already taking 360 micrograms of K, which is good. Now she's wondering if she should even add Ostera, which contains the 500 micrograms of K1. Yes, she should, Bonnie,
right,
because it's K1. It's not K2, okay, and it's perfectly fine.
One exception.
Yeah.
If you're on Coumadin.
If you're on Coumadin,
then
yes,
you have to limit the amount of vitamin K that you get.
If you're on Coumadin, do you have to do the same with something like Pradaxa?
No, not at all.
Eliquis?
No, that's the beauty of those things. There's no dietary restrictions on those products. Vitamin K does not act on them at all.
Yeah.
These are medications that are blood thinners, and the newer medications for atrial fibrillation include Pradaxa and what was the other one?
Eliquis.
Eliquis.
Eliquis, yeah.
A lot of ads for those on TV.
So one of the ways, if you're taking Coumadin, if you're on that blood thinner Coumadin, and you have to watch the amount of vegetables you eat, that's where that K1 comes in. You're going to be restricted in your dark green leafies, even some broccoli, things like that, to no
but not
more
to,
not to elimination.
Right.
Two or three servings a day.
Right.
And to keep it always consistent. Don't have less, have more.
And the shame of it is that the very people who have on these blood thinners often have cardiovascular disease risk.
Yeah.
And they deprive the people of the vitamin K that can actually help prevent cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
So,
which is a shame.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And in fact, here's the other thing. And this is something that I wrote about, I was I think last year or this year. Coumadin actually depletes vitamin K. So you actually get, you can get an acceleration. You can get an acceleration of atherosclerosis in your coronary arteries because of Coumadin, although it's a blood thinner. So this is not great.
So think about that. AFib, and they're afraid you're going to have a stroke, so they give you Coumadin. Meanwhile, that can cause cardiovascular disease.
Can promote it. Yeah.
Trading one problem for another.
Well, that's typical.
Almost.
Yeah. Well, I actually, here's the term that actually one of my guests shared with me recently. And the term is, the cure is the disease. That's what this is about, is there's so much of what happens to people. The cure is the disease. In other words, it's iatrogenic causes of disease.
Caused by treatment is the meaning of iatrogenic.
Right, right.
Fascinating. So Bonnie, don't worry about the K1. Tell your friend, unless she's on Coumadin.
Right. I mean, we're just
that would have to be
saying
lunch.
That just for completeness.
Yeah,
it's not
yeah.
really applicable to this question.
Right. Okay. Let's see here. We have an email from Carol. Carol says, happy holidays. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I have a question about the significance of a high fasting glucose result when all other lab indicators are normal. Her fasting glucose is 103, but so her A1C is a 5.1.
Interesting question. Interesting question.
Yeah. So Carol eats Mediterranean type diet. She's 5'4", 125 pounds.
Right.
That's perfect.
And she's a little
older. She's 67.
She's 67.
She's 67. And she even has triglyceride levels at 90, which is pretty good. An HDL of 101.
Terrific.
Yeah. Yeah. C-reactive protein of less than 0.20.
Mm-hmm.
She's physically active every day, walking, biking, all of that. And she does fast at least 12 hours a night.
Okay.
Which is the rule for all of us human beings, is to be fasting for a minimum.
Time restricted.
Of 12 hours.
Okay.
Yeah. My doctor keeps telling me not to worry about the fasting glucose and that what's more important is the A1C and the overall picture of my other results. Would love to hear what you have to say and any advice.
Well, it's interesting. You know, it's a little bit of a conundrum because it also shows the lack of value of just basing all your assessment on a fasting glucose. Typically, what we'll see sometimes is people with a high fasting glucose in the morning, when cortisol is high, cortisol will raise blood sugar typically in the morning, even if you're fasting. I mean, you may say, you know, I haven't eaten all night. Where's that sugar coming from? Well, it's the cortisol is bringing it out from your glycogen stores. Yeah.
I would ask Carol, is she taking her vitamins before her blood draw? Is she having a cup of coffee before the blood draw? Doctors will say it's okay for you to have your coffee, but don't eat breakfast.
And is she finger sticking? I guess she's finger sticking to see that, right? Or is she?
No, these are just blood tests.
Oh, these are blood tests.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She's concerned about the fasting glucose number always being between 98 and 104.
Well, what you can do, first of all, I agree with the doctor. I think that the hemoglobin A1C is actually a pretty accurate measure of your risk.
Yeah.
Because it measures the glycosylation of your proteins throughout your body.
And
if your proteins are not being glycosylated, you're not seeing the adverse effects of the sugar.
But it's the average. It doesn't tell us about variability.
The excursions, right, exactly.
So there's another blood test called the GlycoMark.
Yes, thank you.
Which can be very beneficial.
Which tells you about excursions.
Your highs and lows.
It's generally used in brittle diabetics.
Yeah.
But it can be used in people with a normal hemoglobin A1C to see if they have relatively large excursions. Mm-hmm. The other thing you can do is you can do a little science fair project. Just go to Duane Reade or one of the big...
Is there a science fair at Duane Reade?
No, it's a science fair. You can do it. A lot of science fair projects. It's like get one of those little glucometers.
Yeah.
And do some finger sticks through the day and see where you're at. And see maybe there are certain foods or trigger foods for you. That if you have them the night before, they cause your blood sugar to be high in the morning. That if you really want to make a scientific project out of that, although that's a little OCD, I would just reassure this person that she's probably doing okay.
Carol.
And by the way, sometimes as people get older, there is a little less strict control on blood sugar.
Yes. The other thing I would mention to Carol is when you're having your blood draw, make sure you don't have a cold or you're not getting over a cold. Or some kind of infection, because that's another scenario where our blood sugars are higher.
Mm-hmm.
It's stress response of the body.
Yep.
Of any of that. Or you've hurt yourself, you've fallen down. I mean,
right.
Trauma.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. Yep. Or you've had a surgery recently or something. That could cause your blood sugar also to go up if you've had a fever.
Effective exercise, do you think? She exercised that morning?
I think that exercise would bring it down.
Down? I think so, too.
I imagine it down. But Carol, if you are having a cup of coffee or tea or something, it is possible that even the little bit of caffeine, even if you're having decaf, a little bit of caffeine can still cause blood sugar to rise.
So here's another way to gauge the effect of sugar, because we're mostly concerned about the brain and the heart, right, when we look at hemoglobin A1C. But what if we're concerned about cancer? If you're concerned about the effects of carbohydrates on your or any dietary constituent on your cancer risk, get an IGF-1 because it's insulin-like
growth factor one.
Which is thought to be promoted also by protein, too much protein in the diet, and it's also associated with too much carbohydrates in the diet. Not affected by fat very much.
Yeah.
And you can see from a cancer standpoint if certain cancers are more likely to occur, such as prostate cancer and or breast cancer, they will actually be reflected in IGF-1. And one of the reasons to go on a low-carb diet if you have prostate cancer is because you'll bring down your IGF-1.
Yes.
But also you don't want to have massive amounts of protein.
That's true. Because protein still does stimulate blood sugar. It stimulates some insulin, but excess protein does turn to blood sugar in the body. And that's the problem there.
Yeah.
People think that a low-carb diet is a high-protein diet. It is not. The protein is still moderate at about 20-25%. It's a high-fat diet.
Yeah, unless you're really recovering from an illness.
Then your protein needs are higher.
Yeah, and or like you're a very high-level athlete.
Mm-hmm.
Then
you'll go to 30% or so, 30-35% or so. Or after a trauma, a surgery. I remember also... rehab, like drug rehabilitation, all that protein needs are higher.
Feed your head.
Yeah, feed your head, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that.
You want the amino acids.
So protein needs are higher in those scenarios.
Well, great. That triggered an interesting discussion.
Yeah.
But, I would reassure that person that, with such a high HDL and really nice low hemoglobin A1C, and all these healthy lifestyle factors...
She's doing everything right.
Yeah.
So kudos to you, Carol, for doing everything right.
Yeah. Don't let one blood marker get you.
Right. Upset. And next time you do get your blood draw, make sure you don't have a cold, you're not getting over an infection.
Yep.
Don't drink a teaspoon of coffee or tea or take your vitamins or anything like that. Just go to the doctor. You can drink as much water as you wish. Plain filtered water, not lemon water, not flavored water. Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. All right. Good. Good stuff. Well, thanks for your questions this week. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the place to send questions. Have a very enjoyable lead up to the holidays. So we may squeeze in another Q&A with Layla before the holidays actually happen. So you during the holiday time, you got a little something to enjoy, some new material.
Yes. Thank you for joining us.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.